How would you like to grow your business the easy way? And in my humble opinion, the fun way, through speaking. Yes, you can literally speak your way to more business, and we can show you how. You know, when I started my coaching business 15 years ago, I struggled making only $900 in the first 2 years. Yeah, you heard that right. Less than $1,000 in 2 years. The problem? I was busy running around to networking events and handing out business cards, trying to help everyone, you know, everyone. Then I took the stage for the first time in my life and began speaking and teaching about the strategies I coached on. And when I really got my message dialed in, my business went literally from 3 figures a year to 7 figures. The secret I finally realized is that when you take the stage, you instantly become seen as the leading voice in your niche or industry. Today, we show entrepreneurs just like you and just like I was how to dominate your niche by becoming the leading voice, not just another expert. We run an incredible business mastermind speaker training program. It's called The Leading Voice. You guessed it. If you head over to leadingvoiceplatform.com/podcast and grab my free roadmap, 8 pillars to profitable speaking. This free roadmap outlines the exact 8 secret weapons you need to truly become the leading voice in your niche. This is exclusively for my podcast listeners. You go to leadingvoiceplatform.com/podcast and start speaking your way to more business. The Purpose Driven Entrepreneur Podcast. We're all about delivering great content, thoughtful discussions, and tips and tricks to help you truly get the most out of your life and business. And here's your charismatic host, me, Matt Browning. Hey, it's Matt Browning. Welcome back to another episode. So stoked this week. Right now, I'm coming off on a pretty big high right now. So as I come to you, if my voice sounds a little more excited than normal, it's because I'm sitting in Tucson, Arizona, as I record this. The last episode, I talked about this a little bit. This morning, I went on and had a wonderful morning show segment. I guess I would just call it a morning show. It's called The Morning Blend in Tucson, and it's an ABC affiliate, and they play it again in the afternoon in Tucson on the CW network. So thanks to CW and ABC and Tina Jennings, who is a wonderful host. We had a lot of fun together. You can find, if you want to check it out, you know what, I'll put a link to it in the show notes just so you can check it out if you want to. It's a really, really fun segment called The 5 Superhero Traits That Every Leader Must Avoid. And I went on there and had some fun props. I brought baby Jack-Jack from The Incredibles, so he was the star of the show. In fact, they made Jack-Jack, me holding him, the thumbnail for the whole video. Apparently, he is a much more compelling character than I am. I also brought some foam Hulk fists, so we had a lot of fun. Me and Tina did some knucks in there. And what else did I bring? Oh, I brought a Spider-Man mask. So it was a really fun segment, and it was the first stop of 12 stops for my media tour for the book coming out. So I just thought I would shout out and let you know that just happened this morning, and it's up on www.kgun9.com for The Morning Blend. And again, I'll put a link to it in the show notes. So I'm excited about that, and I'm going to be hopping on a plane, heading back home for the first time in about a week, getting back home for a couple of days, getting ready to start our 3-day Accelerate, which is our NLP for personal development and for coaches and practitioners, 3-day workshop. So that's very exciting. We have just a little under 200 people registered, ready to come out and you know, have their lives transformed, learn some NLP, and have a lot of fun together. So that's exciting. That's coming up in Orange County. We are sold out on space, but if you would love to attend, actually, no, by the time you listen to this, I think we'll be right in the middle of it. I'm recording this a couple days early because of the event. So so if you're listening and you want to attend, I'll let you know the dates for the next one, and it'll be in January in Orange County, and I would love to see you. So let's get into the content today. Yeah, the last episode I talked about one of the drives in the new book, The Firebox Principle, the 7 drives that fuel every entrepreneur. And the first drive I talked about was the significance drive. again, just to not, I don't want to reiterate it on every single episode, but we're in a series right now of podcasts where every episode is relating to this book as I'm coming up for launch. The book is in pre-release as of the listening of this episode right now. So you can head to Amazon and look for Firebox Principle, or you know, the easiest thing is just fireboxbook.com, and you'll see right there, it'll have a link for Amazon to go pick it up. You can also, of course, rate it or review it. That would help the book amazingly well. You can pick it up for 99 cents for at least the next week while it's on pre-release. And yeah, so you can pick up the book, you can rate, review it, and then head back to the site once you've gotten the book, and then you can take the Firebox quiz, or you can sign up right now. It's not live yet, but you can sign up right now to be the first to get notified as soon as the Firebox quiz is live. So that's all on the fireboxbook.com. Again, it'll be in the show notes. So in this series, I'm taking some time, and instead of just, because you know, I thought about it. I didn't want to just like promote the book and just talk about it just for no reason. What this podcast to me is all about is value, and I know that you're taking your time out of your life. There's a lot of podcasts you can listen to, but there's a reason why we're growing and getting higher and higher in the rankings. In fact, I just looked yesterday, and this is a humbling yet exciting moment. Where did I go? I just have a screenshot here of. I actually dropped in the rankings. I kind of, you know, it goes back and forth every hour, every few minutes, probably on iTunes. But currently in business, in the morning, I was number 42 out of every podcast in the world in the category of business on iTunes, which is pretty cool. So top 100 is amazing. I've actually broken the top 10 for a moment, which is really cool. But right now I'm number 42, and Unshakable by Tony Robbins is number 43. So I have a cool screenshot of me next to one of my mentors in the 42 and 43 spot. So that just made me smile this morning. That was pretty cool. Anyways, let's get moving into, like I said, let's get moving into the content of the book. So the purpose of today is I want to break down one of the drives. And if you're looking, again, if this is your first episode ever, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for listening. Thank you for the stream, the download, the subscription, however you're doing this. But if you haven't listened to any others, I'd suggest going back a few episodes and I go over in depth kind of an overview of why I wrote the book, what the purpose is, how it fits in, and why you need to read it. Today, and for the next few weeks, what I'm going to be doing is breaking down each of these seven drives that are inside the book and sharing some of the examples of people that I've come across, entrepreneurs and visionaries, that I believe share these drives. So it's all my opinion. There's no scientific possible way to determine whose drive is what. But through a series of questions and through the quiz that we're working out right now, I've been looking at the origin stories and that have been shaping these entrepreneurs and what's created them to do the thing that they're doing. So here is number two, which is the artisan drive. The catchphrase for the artisan drive is because it's beautiful. I don't know if you have to sing it or not. Clearly, I'm not a singer, but because it's beautiful. That's the whole reason why you would do or create something. Why do you want to make a business? Because it's beautiful. Here's the thing. I, Matt Browning, I don't paint. I don't sing. I don't write music. I don't sculpt, dance, or really any other creative art in my life. I've never been attracted to that. I love the idea. I love the concept. But it's never been in my bones, you know? Like some people, if you cut them, they bleed art or film or sculpture. And for me, it's not. It's coaching. It's transformation. It's pastoring. It's loving people. Like if you cut me, I'm going to bleed love and I'm going to bleed transformation. So I guess I have a different artistry. Now, if you put me on a stage to speak or to train, I'm in heaven. I'm in absolute heaven. I love it. I get paid quite well by entrepreneurs, all the way up to Fortune 100 companies to do this. But secretly, and here's how you know you might be artisan drive, secretly, I would do it for free. Literally, like, and early in my career, I went into companies or worked with people and I didn't charge them. Or I charge very, very little because the truth is I just wanted to help somebody. I just cared about the work I was doing. And the trouble with the artisan drive is sometimes you can get trapped in that and you can stay in the place where you don't care if you get paid or not. So it can be really useful to get started with something, but not quite as useful to continue, especially like if you want to make it into a business. I'll give you an example. A few years ago, the YMCA asked me to come in and lead a local leadership retreat. It was designed to amplify their corporate culture. So we're sitting in a cabin where they had all their managers and leaders come to outside of Los Angeles area and with their teams. And we started playing the first game. So when I do go in and do corporate leadership work, so whether it's leadership, it's team building, it's corporate culture, I always do it through games and hands-on experience. And then we debrief the games and we teach the leadership lessons through the act of playing the games. So one of the games we played was called Leader, Traitor, Friend. Leader, Traitor, Friend. Not traitor like a stock trader, but traitor like the bad guy. Each person within a group of four draws a piece of paper that says one of those three words. And then each person has to secretly portray that position to the group. And it's so fun because what they try to do is frantically, the whole group tries to get a result together. They try to build something that I show them how to build. But the undercurrent of the project is that each person, you don't know who the traitor is. You don't know who the leader is supposed to be. So, you know, the leader's trying to lead, but he can't come out and say, I'm the leader. And the traitor is trying to sabotage, but they can't come out and say, I'm the traitor. They have to do it in secret. So it's fascinating to watch personalities come out and leadership skills that people think work, but when you take the title of leader away, it doesn't work. So anyways, the whole idea is, the retreats are so much fun. If you can imagine, like, having these grown adults that are all managers and leaders and executives playing these games, and it's like we're all being kids again at a camp retreat. That's amazing. I would do it for free. I love it so much. That's something for me. Like, in the business world, there's a lot that I could do right now. I could do any business, you know, in all humility. I'm sure there's some I couldn't. But for the most part, business is business, and you can switch out content, right? So whether it's hospitality business or it's service business or it's a product business, a lot of the moving parts are the same. Not everything, but a lot. Like, I could sell tires. I could run a dry cleaner. I could do another real estate brokerage. But when I get to dream up new and improved workshops, retreats, keynote talks, when I get into this artist's flow and I nearly disappear, like I forget about myself. And I'll bet there's something in your life you have that makes you disappear, something you like to do. If you are creating a vision or a business or a movement around that thing that causes you pause and makes you disappear, you might have a strong artisan drive inside you. Now, I want to be clear. You don't have to do the thing you love and the thing you artfully do. Like a reverse example of this for me is rock climbing. I love mountaineering and climbing and backpacking. It's one of my favorite, I don't know what I would call that, I guess activities, hobbies. It's something I just love in life and I've loved for almost 20 years. Someone once said, hey, why don't you be a climbing guide? And I thought, that is the stupidest idea I've ever heard. I mean, some people say do what you're passionate about. But I would say, well, if you want to make a business around it because you love it and you would do it for free anyway, as a business, like if all I wanted to do was take my friends out into nature and guide them every time, I might consider guiding. But one of the things I love about rock climbing and mountaineering the most is going with friends and not having that responsibility. So sometimes I love taking someone, but other times I love just to go, you know, my partner David, shout out to David Shea, if you're listening to this, buddy. I love to go just me and David sometimes, and we just, you know, I don't have to guide anyone, right? If anything, he guides me, and we just have some fun, and we hang out, you know, for the weekend, and we climb, and, you know, we get up top of a mountain. So if I turn that into work, it wouldn't feel so good. So here's a few examples of some entrepreneurs that I believe have an artisan drive as their primary drive. And remember, you can have multiple drives. In fact, you're probably going to relate to all seven of the drives in different areas and different contexts. But when you think of the context of your business, your movement, your vision, whatever you're creating or working on right now, you'll probably have one of the drives be primary, another drive be secondary, and depending on which drive is primary, it'll change the focus a little bit. It'll change the behavior. It'll change how it feels. So if these people, I believe, have an artisan drive as primary. Beauty is in the eye of the starter. So for three decades, we have been witnessing history as Apple has rolled out one groundbreaking product after another. I mean, think about it. Like, do you remember the first time you ever saw those old colorful iMacs with the hard drive built into the monitor? That was so new. It was incredible.
Remember watching Steve Jobs on the stage putting 1,000 songs in his pocket, scrolling through them, right, with that wheel design on the first iPod. And then we watched as we never knew we needed a smartphone that had music and maps and videos and a phone and email and all of it together. And guess what? Now we can't live without the iPhone. And we certainly didn't think we needed a laptop and an iPhone and an iPod and an iPad. But then he rolled that out and changed history again. The iPod, unveiled in 2001. Steve Jobs, though, was a dropout. He would occasionally sit in on classes at Reed's College. He wanted to hang around campus, even though he dropped out of college, but he would audit the classes. And I found it fascinating. His biography said one of the classes he audited was calligraphy class. He was enthralled with the idea of beauty. So when he went into the computer programming realm, right, with Steve Wozniak, but he brought in with him this idea of beauty. So in those days, right, if you remember like the first early computers, and again, was it just before? I was very, very little at that point. You know, we didn't have a computer at home. No one had a home computer when I was a kid. Steve, though, wanted to bring the beauty of the real world and bring it into the computer world. And he was a genius because he could speak the language of engineers, but he also had a love for arts and humanities. He devoured Shakespeare, Dylan Thomas, the writings of Plato. He became interested in Zen Buddhism and followed the great American philosopher Bob Dylan. Huge fan of Dylan. Steve wasn't unfamiliar with the right side of the brain, is my point. So as he's building Apple, as an entrepreneur, he wanted to build smart tech machinery, but he wanted it to be beautiful. He was so focused on what the outcome looked like and felt like and how the designers created the product, right? You can imagine other executives or other CEOs, other founders of tech companies, whether it's Cisco maybe systems or Panasonic or HP. And I'm making these up, right? I haven't looked at each one of the owners to tell you which drive they have. But if you look at like probably a company like a Cisco, you're most likely not going to find artistry or the artisan drive as the primary drive. See, some tech companies start to, oddly enough, to make a profit. Or some start because they have this genius idea of impacting and changing the world, right? You look at Elon Musk, the tech companies that he has, the energy company of Tesla, that wasn't about making a beautiful car. Now, do you think that it's important to Elon Musk to have something that's beautiful? I think so, right? You can tell by the lines of a Tesla. But Elon is a good example of an entrepreneur with a primary world impact drive, which we'll get to in a later episode, and a secondary, most likely secondary, artisan drive. Whereas Steve Jobs, if you look at it, I would say, Steve, you'd reverse that. He had primary artisan drive, and you can tell because of the detail of the products and how important it really was. Secondary to Steve would probably be world impact drive. He always talked about wanting to make a dent in the universe. So he once said, Steve said, the only way to do great work is to love what you do. That's so cool. Now, there's a lot of entrepreneurs that have the artisan drive, and it's not just artists. You know, you could think of, you know, Andy Warhol, who left a corporate job to open the Silver Room, right? Or Kanye West, and the stir of Jim Carrey's political paintings. Jim Carrey has this amazing, I don't know if you saw this, it was on a show recently on Houses. No, it was on Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee with Jerry Seinfeld, and he went and visited Jim Carrey and went in the house, and you see that he has these amazing paintings. But again, what inspires the people to start and get moving? Well, sometimes it's a starving artist idea. You don't have to be a starving artist to be the artisan drive. So, you know, money can change behaviors. Let me give you an example from a long time ago. So there's a famous novelist, Jane Austen. She wrote Sense and Sensibility and other amazing, very famous works. She lived in the late 1700s. She was born a month late into a poor home in Stevenson, England. Her father was a church rector, and they had wealthy relatives, but they struggled to get by. So see, like in this time and place, women were literally considered too delicate to earn a living and too fragile to even have an opinion. So for Jane Austen, she wasn't expected to create any kind of wealth for her or for her family. And I think it's, to me, it's so interesting that as she got into the work, Jane, she never expected fame that she received. And she never expected compensation. Like, she didn't do the work. She didn't write the books because she wanted to become a famous novelist. That wasn't the deal. You know, they were full of personal flair and what she had been through. You know, the norms in British society at the time were really, they're what dictated her expectations. Her brothers were the ones who expected to provide for the family. It wasn't her, it was them. So in the spirit of the age at the time, her only hope, Jane Austen's only hope, was to marry up. If Jane or her sister were able to marry into wealth, it would be considered a job well done, right? And as Jane started writing Sense and Sensibility, it was always, she always had this very cool, like open, amused, very easy and intellectual atmosphere. She had some strong, successful women in her life. One of them wrote a novel, and another traveled extensively abroad, which again was not common at the time for women. But she never saw writing as a career. It wasn't an option. That writing as a career didn't exist in the reality of a woman of the cultural and financial status of Jane Austen in the 1700s. So you might think, like, if you hear that today, you know, a lot of cultural norms don't really age well, in my opinion. So if you hear this in 2018, you think, oh my gosh, if I was a woman then, right, or whoever is being disenfranchised, if I was in that position, I would want to change something. So you might think it was the Avenger drive maybe that was driving, or the world impact drive to shift things for women or to shift things for the author culture, but it wasn't. It wasn't. We'll get into those in later episodes and their later chapters in the book. For Jane, it was all about the work. Everything she loved, the reason she did it and made it as popular as it became, was writing was everything to her. She kept applying herself to writing, and she didn't really become successful until much later in life. I love one of my favorite quotes from Jane Austen. She said this about her book, Sense and Sensibility. "I am never too busy to think of S&S. I can no longer forget it than a mother can forget her suckling child." She was enthralled and wrapped by the concept of the book. To her, she said, the book had to be written. It had to be written. So I remember I was speaking to a friend recently who I believe has a strong artisan drive. And they said their number one advice, right? Everybody wants to tweak their creation to make it more marketable. And me included. I'm going to say, hey, I love this concept, or I love this book, but what if you change the title? What if you did this, that, the other thing, and it would become much, much more marketable? And this is what my friend said. To change my creation to make it marketable feels like selling out. It tarnishes my true nature and the entire reason I create. Even defining my client market. I said, what about just defining who you're selling to? She said, even defining my client market still feels like it limits what I can do and who can benefit from it. It still feels like selling out. And I think the last good example that I want to get into is Warren Buffett. Now, Warren Buffett is best known for being one of the wealthiest men in the entire world. He was number two for a long time, and I think, you know, now he's down to, think, number three or number four, as Jeff Bezos and some other people have come up. But Warren Buffett has always been known for money, investing, and building companies. But what you might not realize is the drive for Warren to make the money, to make the great investments, to create these companies, in my humble opinion, I don't believe it's really money-driven. And here's why. You know, right now he's showing up as the third richest person in the entire world. He was born in Omaha, Nebraska, and in 1930, right? So he was born right at the cusp of the Great Depression, and he came from a line of business owners. His grandfather started a grocery store in Omaha. His father had started a small stock brokerage firm before he became a U.S. congressman. So he has, you know, you could almost see some of the significance drive possibly in Warren, although I don't see it. But you could see coming from a family like that, who knows where he could have gone. But Warren fell in love with something different. You know, as he was a child growing up, a very frugal time, as you might imagine, he had a lot of small business ventures where he, like, for instance, one of the ones, he sold bottles of Coke, he sold packs of chewing gum, he sold magazines door to door. But he always expressed a desire to be rich someday. And I think most of the kids growing up post-Great Depression era probably would have expressed the ideology, easy for me to say, of being rich someday, because you grow up with no money. He began to grow his investments and he started to understand how to navigate markets. And he realized this, it wasn't the money he wanted. It was the thrill of getting it. Can I really make this happen? Like, I think it's easy to look at people that invest in Wall Street and think, oh, all of them must be, you know, the Wolf of Wall Street. They all must be after the money and the greed. But that's not the case. You know, that's no different than looking at the arts and music and thinking everybody that paints paintings or writes music must be inspired by the artisan drive. Not the case. Some people who write music were all about making the money. Some people are all about becoming known. Some people are all about the music. Some people are all about the impact on the people of the music. And the same is true in reverse for the money industry or the investment industry. You know, look at Warren Buffett. He still lives. He's become very famous. He still lives in the same Omaha home that he purchased in 1959. He's the predominant owner, the chairman, and CEO of the third largest public company in the world, Berkshire Hathaway. Yet he drives a seven-year-old vehicle to McDonald's every morning where he orders his sausage and egg McMuffin on the way to work. He gets a new car. I mean, nowadays he gets a new Cadillac every 5 years or so, which isn't that extravagant if you think about it. He has one nice car that he enjoys driving. He drives it for a while, and then eventually he upgrades every 5, 7, 10 years. Buffett doesn't love money. He eats a $2 egg and sausage and egg McMuffin for breakfast, for goodness sakes, right? He could have his own personal chef, a million of them. He doesn't do that. He loves the strategic process of playing the stock market. To me, he has a dominant artisan drive because it's the art of the game that he loves more than anything else in the entire world. And that was going to be the last one. I'll end with one last example that's straight from the book as well. John McAfee, the founder of McAfee Antivirus. He sold the antivirus company for $100 million back in 1994 when he stepped down. Now, McAfee's an interesting character, especially he's in the media a ton recently with, you know, his exploits in Belize. He was actually on the presidential card, if you, I don't know if you realize that, under like a cyber party. And he's been coming out recently talking about cryptocurrency and offering to decrypt phones for federal agencies to find criminals. He's a very, very unique character. What some of you might not know is John McAfee, I actually got to know him pretty well. He was my first private client ever over 10 years ago when I was first getting into the coaching business. He had come to a seminar in San Diego. And so he's one of the few that I really had a chance to know and talk about. And so long before all the craziness and what's going on today, John, you know, he was a pretty normal guy. He sold his company. And he had a phase where he became a yogi and opened an entire yoga retreat outside of Colorado Springs. When I met him, he had started an aerotrekking pilot phase. He became a light aircraft pilot and had an entire private airport and runway all set up in Rodeo, New Mexico at the time. And he's not there any longer. All for private pilots to do this fun aerotrekking thing. Well, what's interesting is, when it comes to McAfee Antivirus, you think, hey, you built this company, you sold it for $100 million, it must be about the money. And here's what he told me. He had no intention of ever generating revenue with the company. That's not why he started it. He loved the idea, the art, of outsmarting the virus creators. So to him, he was living actually in this open source world, like, you know, Firefox and programmers that are really into like the browser Firefox. And different open source platforms, meaning everyone can contribute, they can see the code, they can offer improvements to it. There's a whole category of work that these people are, you can write all this code and you're not getting the benefit of, they're not going to pay you because you fixed the browser a little bit. What's going to happen instead, though, is you're going to get the satisfaction, the art, of making something better, of figuring it out, and that's what's so cool for a lot of these artisan drive entrepreneurs. McAfee loved the puzzle of figuring it all out. In fact, he initially put all his software, I don't know if you know this, but McAfee originally was available as open source software, free on message boards, and it's in the software community. One day he got a call, and this is what he told me, we were having bacon and eggs in his house, and over breakfast he said, one day I got a call, and I'm paraphrasing. He didn't say these word for word, but this is his story. He told me, one day I got a call from a fairly good-sized company They asked how much the yearly license fee was per desktop computer. He told me he didn't have a license cost. He didn't tell them that. He told me that. So he thought, well, this is an opportunity. I never considered this. But so he mentioned a nominal fee to them, some small amount. I don't remember what it was. And I wouldn't tell you right now anyway. But a really, really small amount. You know, 10 or let's call it $15 a computer or something. And they said, oh, okay, no problem. Then he asked, well, how many computer units are you running? They replied with a number that was in the thousands. And within a few days, he got a substantial five-figure check just days later. And that's when he realized, he said, I have more here than I thought. And they began to change how McAfee antivirus got out. The point is, he never started writing antivirus software to become rich and famous or to make a bunch of money or even really to impact the world. He wrote it because it was fun, because he liked to outsmart the virus writers and he liked to contribute to the open source community. So when it comes to the artisan drive, it's very, very motivated by the love of the content itself, right? Leaders with a dominant artisan drive will make careful decisions. They might seem impulsive. Sometimes they are. But on the positive side, like, you're never going to find someone more passionate about the thing they do than the artisan drive person. You know, you're never going to find that. You can get a great, loyal, exciting, passionate brand, a great leader when it comes to the artisan drive. Now, there's some things to watch out for. And in the quiz, as soon as the quiz comes out, you'll find out more about this. We go through some of the fears, some of the concerns, some of the risks, and then some of the strengths as well of having a strong artisan drive. If you're leading, you know, motivation to chase the dream and to have your hands dirty in the art of it, the artisan drive person opens a restaurant because they love to create the meals, right? That's the chef that wants to get their expression out to the world. They're not doing it to become a famous chef. They're doing it because they love the food they create and they want someone to enjoy it. Give yourself permission to do the thing that you crave. If you want to start a business or a movement, and the thing you love more than anything is the art of the thing you do, give yourself permission to do it. Find someone else to help you in it, maybe to partner with you, to do the parts that aren't the passionate part for you. Don't risk losing yourself. Don't risk not being able to how am I want to say this? Don't risk like giving up the dream of cooking that amazing food and making those creations to run payroll. You'll have to do those things. And the artisan drive entrepreneur will struggle most likely with some of the logistical parts of work, some of the practical day-to-day parts of entrepreneurship. So if you can know ahead of time as an artisan drive person that you know what's driving you, you can then on purpose get yourself to focus on some of the logistical day-to-day stuff, and that's going to take you a long, long way. So I hope this was fun and valuable. This was kind of, again, one of the shorter episodes. For the next few weeks, I'm going to be doing more of these just to jump into the book and have some fun. And while I was recording this, literally from the beginning to the end, just so you know, thanks for listening, subscribing on the podcast. The book, The Firebox Principle, is now officially available. I just got a text message from my publisher. They said it is up on Amazon for pre-order. The official launch will be coming at the end of this week. So by the time you listen to this right here, right now, it might even be just officially released. So if you wouldn't mind, the best way is to head over to fireboxbook.com. Fireboxbook.com. You can check out the book. You can grab it on Amazon, leave a star rating and a review. Please, if you would leave a review on Amazon, that'll change everything. And then head back to fireboxbook.com after you've bought it and left the review, and then you can take the Firebox quiz. And currently, like I said, you can sign up for the Firebox quiz, and the moment it gets released and the bugs are worked out, you will be the first to get notified, so you can take the quiz and it's completely free. All right. Have an awesome week. Have an awesome weekend. Enjoy yourself. Give yourself a pat on the back. And if you are an artisan, congratulations. Live with passion.